The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas looks set to go into effect, but in Israel, the discord continues.
Very few people feel outright that this is a great deal.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Also today, the German political party rising fastest in the polls has been accused of pushing racist and xenophobic policies.
They're at the stage now that they don't care anymore if the vast majority of the public are against their ideas.
And big changes for Hockey Night in Canada. It will now be broadcast sometimes in two Indigenous languages.
Using Canada's number one sport to promote our language has been nothing less than phenomenal.
Pretty cool, eh?
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas looks set to go into effect, more than 15 months after the start of a war that began with the Hamas attack on southern Israel. The deal, which would pause the fighting, was reached on Wednesday, but hung in the balance as Prime Minister Netanyahu deliberated over details.
Netanyahu says Israel's attacks will not end until Sunday at the earliest. The ceasefire would last for 6 weeks and include the release of 33 Israeli hostages and hundreds of Palestinians being held in Israeli jails. To learn more about reaction inside Israel and what this means politically for Netanyahu, I spoke with journalist Noga Tarnopolsky. She is based in Jerusalem.
Inside the country, there's really a complex array of unhappiness with this deal. You have the most extreme right-wing nationalists, theocrats, who until a few days ago still hoped to be able to, you know, colonize Gaza and install a Jewish theocracy there. And we're saying so out loud. Netanyahu has allowed his ministers and his base to openly entertain these kind of fantasies for the last 15 months. And they are now feeling that they were lied to. So that's the ultra-right. Then you have non-political families who just, whatever their private political beliefs, they don't trust the government. They don't trust Hamas. They're not sure what incoming President Donald Trump will demand from Netanyahu. And they're terrified that their family members are going to be left to rot and die in Gaza. The other thing to remember is Netanyahu, throughout this war, has promised his cabinet and Israelis what he's been calling total victory and the absolute destruction of Hamas. Now, the fact that it was never an achievable military goal in the real world didn't bother him from using these slogans on and on and on. And many people who believed him now also feel betrayed.
So that's the public, it sounds like. Members of Netanyahu's cabinet have threatened to resign if this ceasefire deal goes through, and the governing coalition is in question right now. Can you tell us more about what the future looks like for Netanyahu's government?
So Itamar Ben-Gvir, the very powerful national security minister, said that he would resign once the cabinet accepted this deal. We know that the cabinet has accepted this deal, but we haven't heard of his resignation yet. But let's assume that he'll follow through. The other very extremist minister, Smotrich, the finance minister, hasn't really made his plans clear, but he's expected to stick around at least for a few weeks to see what happens with the phase two negotiations that are supposed to start on the 16th day. He says that the prime minister promised him a return to full-on war. If that is the case, that means that Netanyahu is promising his cabinet members something that directly contravenes the letter and the spirit of the same agreement that he's signing.
Interesting dynamic there in Israel. And Netanyahu's popularity plummeted in the aftermath of October 7th. Since then, he has managed to not only stay in power, but also regain some of the backing and support that he lost. This is clearly, as we've been talking about, a very fragile moment. But do you expect Netanyahu will survive all of these challenges?
Netanyahu's a great survivor, so I wouldn't wager against him. Let's put it this way. If he really does lose Ben-Gvir, and if this agreement stays in place, at least for these first 42 days, that's not a good sign for him. Not because he will lose an automatic parliamentary majority, but simply because beginning to shed parties in a coalition government is a sign that things are beginning to fall apart. What's interesting about Netanyahu's current predicament is that he's actually promised stability. So that even if he loses both of these extremist parties, the chairman of the opposition, Yair Lapid, a former prime minister, has said that his party will provide what he's calling a parliamentary safety net for Netanyahu. In other words, they will not try to topple Netanyahu so long as hostages are being released.
So it sounds like Netanyahu is risking a lot here politically by launching the ceasefire deal.
He is. He's also gaining something super important, which he's tried to gain and failed to for the last year. He's distracting the public with something huge and momentous. And behind the scenes, he's trying to enact the same anti-democratic authoritarian legislation that his government spent all of 2023 before the war trying to do. He has also requested another week's delay in his own trial. So we're seeing a lot of activity behind the scenes. And this is also producing anxiety for those Israelis who still are observing what this government is doing, apart from all of the noise around the hostage release.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a journalist based in Jerusalem. Canadian hockey is getting a new sound. The nation's most popular sport will now be broadcast in Indigenous languages for at least a few nights a year. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Growing up, Robert Kvitok played hockey with local kids in Rankin Inlet, an Inuit settlement on the coast in northern Canada. On Saturday nights, he'd watch NHL games on the nationwide broadcast.
Live on CBC, Hockey Night in Canada.
I would watch it with my dad, and he's a real Montreal fan. So we would watch Montreal versus Toronto or Montreal versus Boston.
There was just one problem. Kvitok's dad doesn't speak English. He speaks Inuktitut, an Inuit language. Meanwhile, Kvitok had learned English at school and was losing his mother tongue.
So I couldn't translate to him.
So Kvitok would watch the game and listen to the commentary, while his dad would simply watch. It's been that way ever since. Until this hockey season. For the first time, the nationwide Hockey Night in Canada broadcast is being offered in Inuktitut. And Kvitok, who has since relearned his mother tongue, is part of the show.
I'm going to be excited, you know, speaking my language in Hockey Night in Canada.
The broadcasts are a partnership between Sportsnet and APTN, the Aboriginal People's Television Network. There will be three games broadcast in Inuktitut, and Kvitok expects it to appeal to a wide age range.
Having another language like Inuktitut might promote our language for the younger generation and help hold our elders that have been saying for how many years that we need to speak it more. So this is a big step, I'd say.
The new Inuktitut broadcasts come on the heels of Hockey Night in Canada in Cree, another Indigenous language. Earl Wood has been analyzing NHL games in Cree since 2019. It's just a few games per year, but he says it's important for speakers to use whatever they can to preserve Indigenous languages.
Using Canada's number one sport to promote our language has been nothing less than phenomenal.
Wood says the show has also helped the Cree language evolve and modernize. There aren't always direct translations for hockey terms, so he and the broadcast crew come up with new ones that will make sense to Cree speakers.
You know, they bumped into each other, eh? He's skating hard, here he comes, you know. Yeah, he's coming, dancing in, carrying in the puck. Eh?
Both Wood and Robert Kvitok consider it an honor to be the ones speaking their native languages on the broadcasts. But Kvitok says there is one other place he wishes he could be during that first game in Inuktitut.
I wish I was behind my dad watching him. Seeing his reaction, just listening to the Inuktitut Hockey Night in Canada. He's going to be so excited.
This season's first Indigenous language broadcast is tomorrow night when the Winnipeg Jets play the Calgary Flames. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Greenland is in the global spotlight after President-elect Donald Trump said he wanted to buy it. The island is a self-governing territory of Denmark. Greenland's Prime Minister Mutta Bie-Iel said in a press conference that Greenland belongs to the Greenlandic people.
For the Grønland er Grønlandernes. Vi vil ikke være danskere. Vi vil ikke være amerikanere.
We do not want to be Danish, he said. We do not want to be American. We want to be Greenlandic. This week, Denmark's prime minister weighed in. She told Trump that the territory's future was in Greenland's own hands. Maliarak Ingel grew up in Greenland. She is a member of Greenland's Inuit community and a student at University of Copenhagen. I asked her about Denmark and Greenland's colonial history.
Denmark colonized Greenland officially in 1721. And for over two centuries, Greenland was under Danish control. But even after formal colonization ended in 1953, the structures of colonialism persisted and influenced Greenland's governance, economy, and cultural identity to this day. The relationship today is often framed by a narrative that Denmark acted with the best intentions, emphasizing modernization and development. But, however, historical records show that many policies, such as the monopolization of trade and forced relocations, were implemented to serve Danish interests. And this reflects a colonial power dynamic where Greenland's resources and labor were exploited while Greenlandic culture and autonomy were marginalized.
You mentioned that some of the colonial structures still exist, you know, even though official colonization is long gone. Can you tell me what that means, what that looks like?
Well, colonial structures, the system that was created during the colonization, are still influencing Greenland today. Like, for example, Denmark monopolized, as I told before, Greenland's trade for centuries and defined the norms, such as making Danish the dominant language in education and governance. Like, these systems favor those who can navigate in them while marginalizing the others who don't fit the imposed standards.
So you have an interesting perspective. You grew up in Greenland and you moved to Denmark to study. How has moving to Denmark changed your understanding of the relationship between Denmark and Greenland?
Well, speaking for myself, I think it's a paradox that I moved from Greenland to Denmark to learn about my own country.
Why can't you learn about your own culture in Greenland?
Because we're taught about Danish culture in Greenland, mostly. Historically, for many years, it's been like that. Of course, the narratives has finally begun to change since most post-colonial societies have been asking more nuanced question about the colonial history, and I'm more aware of the fact that it wasn't possibly only good intentions, if good intentions at all, that they were colonized. Speaking for myself, I learned a lot about Danish culture and Danish history when I went to elementary school in Greenland, and not as much about Greenlandic culture or why we even had the history between us.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't learn why Greenland was colonized or that it was even colonized.
Mm. So Greenland already has self-rule with its own prime minister and government, though I know that Denmark controls other aspects. So when Greenland talks about independence, what exactly is it looking to change?
Well, as I said before, self-government, self-rule is essentially managing Greenland with Danish-defined structures. It's basically just a copy of Danish systems applied locally. So independence, on the other hand, would mean true self-determination, the right to define and decide on structures and frameworks that reflects Greenland's own needs.
Polls show that a majority of people in Greenland want independence. Having grown up there, what is your opinion on independence personally?
I think it's really interesting that it's even a question, why it is even framed as a question, since independence is a universal aspiration.
Maliarak Ingel is a member of Greenland's indigenous Inuit community and a student at University of Copenhagen.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Ramesh Ranganathan is a British-born comedian with Sri Lankan immigrant parents, and his identity is often a part of his routine. Here he is on The Late Late Show with James Corden.
Hello, hello. Very excited to be here. Thank you very much. I realised as I walked out immediately, some of you became concerned. Like, oh, God, James has booked a brown comedian. Is he going to be going on about being brown the whole time? Please don't worry. only about 10% of my stuff is based on me being brown. The other 90% is based on my issues with white people.
Ramesh Ranganathan is now on the U.S.-Canadian leg of his Hustle Tour, and he joined me in the studio here at GBH. Ramesh, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I understand this current tour is all about exploring how different cultures maintain a work-life balance. It's called the Hustle Tour. Now, how about you? You're a father of three kids on a comedy tour. How's that going?
Great. I mean, I really do have to crank up how difficult it is to my wife when I phone her, because obviously I'm working an hour and a half a night. And she is, you know, she's dealing with three boys that have got a lot of demands.
Now, you grew up in Crawley, a town about 30 miles south of London. How did you get interested in comedy?
I fell into comedy, or my love of comedy, through American stand-up. What happened was, actually, when I was a kid, I had no idea that stand-up was a thing. And I really got into Eddie Murphy's films. And I didn't realise that he was a stand-up as well. And then one day I came across Raw, which is his stand-up special where he's in the purple suit, the leather suit. And I just thought it was absolutely incredible. I just, you know, the whole concept of one person and a microphone, and that is it, that's the show. I remember just being completely blown away by it, and then became obsessed with it. But then I ended up I became a teacher. I taught maths, or math as you call it over here. And then I thought I'd start doing stand-up as a hobby. And so it kind of was by accident. I was enjoying teaching. There's another Ramesh that would have spent the rest of his years being a teacher and would have been perfectly happy. I really did love teaching, and I loved kind of working with young people and all of that. So it kind of happened by accident.
Did comedy come in handy as a math teacher?
Yes. Teaching maths, I think that the kids are often so uninterested. I mean, I remember there's a stat. Their age in years is the same as the number of minutes that they're able to pay attention to you for any amount of time. And so often you'd be looking for interesting and funny ways of delivering stuff that's on the face of it quite dry. And so I'd often kind of look at different ways of delivering it and stuff.
What were the ages of the kids you were teaching math to?
11 to 18.
So you got between 11 minutes and 18 minutes.
Correct. That's exactly right, yeah.
Across 18 minutes max, yeah. Your humor is often self-deprecating and pretty deadpan. Here's a clip from one of your acts.
Doesn't matter how much hotter the woman is, men have got no idea what they look like. All of my friends, solid fours, right? And they walk around, oh, she's a bit of all right. I have to say to them, do you understand how out of your league that woman is? Do you understand that if you're in a couple with that girl, people would assume that you're a millionaire with a terminal illness? Do you understand? You don't deserve to breathe the same air as that girl. My friend's deluded. I swear to God, if I wasn't married, if you weren't married, you'd be alone. All right, so why don't you call your jets, phone your wife and apologise to her for still being married to her, instead of pretending you've got options.
What does self-deprecation do for you in your comedy sets? Or is it just sort of part of who you are?
I just think it's part of who I am. I think that when you're starting out doing stand-up, you're trying to find what your voice is, and you're trying to find out what works for you. And, you know, when you first start doing stand-up, you're just throwing everything at the wall, just, you know, trying to find laughs. Then as you get more experience, you start to discover what works for you and what you enjoy writing about. And you know, it turns out just sort of like my own kind of foibles and issues are kind of fertile ground for me, comedy-wise. I mean, the truth is, you know, I don't ever really write routines. I'll think about what I want to talk about. And then when I first do that routine, I just try and find the funny on stage. And one of the problems with being self-deprecating is sometimes the audience will feel sorry for you. You know, when you let them into how you feel about yourself sometimes, or what you think about yourself. The truth is that I just always have been very self-deprecating. I do think it's a form of narcissism, really beating yourself up and saying you're the worst person. I do think that is a form of ego as well.
But stand-up is also incredibly brave. It's just you, a microphone, and a crowd.
Yeah.
And you are completely dependent on your material and the particular crowd that night.
Yes.
So you're right out there. You're completely exposed and vulnerable.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what kind of makes it so exciting, really, because no matter how much you think you've mastered it, you know, no matter how good you think your show might be, you could go out that evening and it can just go terribly. And even though that's horrible when it happens, I think that's what makes it so addictive. You know, people often say, when you start doing stand-up, when you have a few good gigs, which you often do when you start out, you don't know whether you're a stand-up yet. If you have a terrible gig and you walk off stage going, I need to go and do this again to make that right, that's when you know that stand-up's in your blood, really.
Now, I'm wondering how your parents reacted to you wanting to become a comedian.
They were worried. I was teaching maths, and they saw that as like a really respectable, reliable profession. And so when I told them I was leaving to do comedy, they were worried. I mean, they just didn't see, they couldn't really see how you can make money. They just thought it's such a high-risk strategy. I think they were just really concerned. And also, you know, my mum, as much as she denies it, does worry a little bit about what the Sri Lankan community or what her friends think. And so they were all going, you know, I can't believe your son was a teacher and now he's leaving you to tell jokes. This is crazy. You know, so she was worried about that. And now my mum, you know, I've had this discussion with my mum where when I started doing television in the UK and started like getting and hosting my own shows and stuff, my mum would say to me, you know, I'm so glad you've made it now. You've made it now. But, you know, the point I made to her is you don't have to be doing TV to, you know, I could be paying my bills from doing stand-up and nobody's heard of me. And that to me still is making it. But to my mum, she got that sort of external validation that TV shows are booking her son and stuff like that. So now she's happy. I've done TV shows with her and, you know, she's really comfortable now and she, you know, she's in a nice house. And
what was it like having her as part of your act?
It was great. You know, we did a show called Asian Provocateur, which was where I went back to Sri Lanka to get in touch with my roots. Because, you know, there's a phrase in the UK that sometimes you use to South Asian people that they're a coconut, which means brown on the outside, white on the inside. And that was, I was doing a stand-up routine at the time about my mum calling me a coconut because she felt like I didn't know enough about my Sri Lankan heritage. And so this travel show that we did was like, we filmed with mum, and so mum was like telling me you should do this, you should do that. And then when the show went out, she was just a breakout star of that show. Just, you know, she was just, people were just going mad for her. And so then I remember when we were promoting that show, we went on the chat show, and on the chat show, in front of a studio audience, she still stole the show. And then I thought, okay, I've created a monster. This is actually, I thought this is good, but this now might be a problem.
Ramesh Ranganathan is on the road now with his Hustle Tour. Material from that show will air as a 4-part travelogue series called Can't Knock the Hustle, starting this month on SkyMax. It will follow Ramesh as he performs across the U.S., Canada, India, and South Korea, exploring how different cultures deal with work-life balance. Thank you so much, Ramesh.
Thank you, Carol.
Teaching history can be tricky, especially when it's embarrassing for some.
Many Okinawans remain unreconciled with the wartime past because the government has tried to suppress these memories and tried to burnish this history.
Japan's behavior during the Battle of Okinawa, ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Remigration has become a buzzword among far-right lawmakers in Germany and Austria. The term is widely understood to mean the mass deportation of people from a migrant background. Just a year ago, the word was considered taboo in Germany, even among far-right politicians. But a lot has changed since then, as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
On Tuesday, residents in Karlsruhe, a city in southwestern Germany, got an odd-looking flyer in the mail. It looks like a plane ticket. On the front are the words, Departure, Germany. And beside it, Destination, Safe Country of Origin. On the back is a statement, Only remigration can still save Germany. The fake deportation tickets are part of an election campaign stunt by the AfD, Germany's far-right party. I don't think we're scaring people with this, AfD lawmaker Mark Bernhard says as he shuffles some flyers in his hand. If you look closely at the plane ticket or the flyer, he says, it says illegal migrants. It's only got to do with the 300,000 or so people who are here illegally, he tells German television. German police say they've launched a criminal investigation into the leaflet campaign on suspicion of incitement to hatred. Just a couple of days earlier, AfD party leader Alice Weidel gave a fiery speech at a party conference.
Die deutschen Grenzen sind dicht, liebe Freunde. Sie sind
the German
dicht.
Borders are closed. Closed, she said. That's our message to the whole world. And then she added,
wenn es dann Remigration heißen soll, dann heißt es eben Remigration.
If it's going to be called remigration, then that's what it's going to be. Remigration, she said. It's all a far cry from just a year ago. Tens of thousands of people marched in Berlin after news emerged that senior members of the AfD had attended a meeting with right-wing extremists and neo-Nazis and openly discussed remigration. Weidel distanced herself from those party members. There was even a widespread debate at the time about whether the AfD should be banned in Germany altogether. But 12 months on, something has shifted with the far-right party.
They're at the stage now that they don't care anymore if the vast majority of the public are against their ideas, because they have mobilized a lot of people and they don't care anymore.
Rolf Frankenberger heads up the Institute for Research on Far-Right Extremism at Tübingen University in southwestern Germany. With the general election looming in February, he says, the AfD appears to be happy to peddle more extreme ideas. Richard McNeil Wilson, an expert in right-wing extremism at Edinburgh University, says remigration is a concept that's embedded in white nationalism.
You know, framed in the language of rights for white people, it needs to be underlined that this is an entirely racist approach and white supremacist approach towards migration policy.
And it's very much targeted at ethnic minorities, Muslim communities and Syrians in particular, he says. Alice Weidel, the AfD leader, was asked this week what exactly she means when she says she wants to see remigration introduced in Germany. I told you, she says to the reporter, it concerns illegal immigrants who haven't been deported and who commit crimes on a large scale. They don't belong here, she says. McNeil Wilson says that's not how she explains the policy to her own supporters.
The language that she's used elsewhere and to party members is not just focused on stopping asylum seeking. It's about stopping migration as much as possible.
And this sort of rhetoric, he says, is also being adopted by more mainstream parties across Europe, who are more intent on boosting voter support. For many in Germany, though, the word remigration has very unsettling connotations.
I hear concentration camps and it reminds me of our National Socialist past in a way.
Rolf Frankenberger says using terms like this so openly also keeps people of a migrant background continually on edge. And it's not just far-right lawmakers in Europe who are at it either. Last September, President-elect Donald Trump posted a tweet calling for remigration in the US. He also promised mass deportations of undocumented migrants if elected to office. Frankenberger says what many lawmakers seem to forget is just how much countries, like Germany, actually need migrants.
We're a shrinking society. We have a lack of skilled workers. On the other hand, we want to exclude all those people from helping us as a society to grow and make new experiences. It's ridiculous. And I really hate it.
There are so many pressing problems facing Germany right now, he says. And honestly, undocumented migrants really isn't one of them. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
We've been told that artificial intelligence, or AI, can be used for good or bad, perhaps even evil. Well, we now have another example of that. AI can be used to generate images showing the sexual abuse of children, and people are posting them online. The spread of these images is a new problem for law enforcement and watchdogs. Dan Sexton is Chief Technology Officer at the Internet Watch Foundation, a British charity that is trying to fight against the availability of child sexual abuse images online.
The amount of content we find is still predominantly real images and videos of children that have been sexually abused. So AI-generated content still makes up a small portion of that, but it is a growing concern, and there are growing communities that are being dedicated to the creation of ever more severe types of AI-generated abuse.
And where is this being generated? Can you identify where it is globally?
So we can't see where it's being created, and we don't know who is creating it or who is accessing it. The only things we can say is we've seen a high concentration in parts of the dark web, and particularly in an area where the child sexual abuse communities go to talk about what they're doing, to share images. And there are dedicated areas of there which are dedicated to the use of generative AI to create content.
What about how this is being generated? Is it sort of, is it in somebody's house or at a more industrial level, these AI images?
So certainly the early examples, so strong indication that these are on people's computers. The AI tools, particularly the openly available and open source tools and models that were being shared on the internet, became good enough and easy enough and more powerful enough. People could download it free, put it on their computers, and then start putting in prompts to create realistic images of child sexual abuse.
How do you go after it?
The mechanisms we would use to prevent sharing and distribution are the same mechanisms we would use for real child sexual abuse. So that relies on organizations like the IWF to find, assess the imagery, to add it to what we call hash lists, to create digital fingerprints, and get that data out to industry platforms that can then identify that content without having to look at it and block it. And that's still a very successful method of blocking harmful and illegal content.
These AI-generated images that exploit children, they're not of actual living children. Does that affect the ability to apply current laws and policies to those creating and posting them?
Well, actually, in many cases, they are of actual real children. And what we've seen in these communities is, as soon as these tools were available, people would be asking for new images, particularly new images of existing victims, which is incredibly shocking. These are children that have been, very likely have been safeguarded already. The perpetrators that abused them are found and arrested, but their content is still being shared in these communities. They're sort of collecting it like I guess in the US with like baseball cards or something. I mean, it is shocking to think about it, but this is how these people are functioning. And now they're asking, can someone create more images of a particular victim?
This question's going a little bit sideways, but I feel like I need to ask it anyway. Has much work been done to understand the psyche or mindset of people who trade in images of child sexual abuse?
So this is not whatever the stereotype is that people would assume here. We've seen research which has highlighted the different groups and parts of society that are known to have engaged in or have sexual interest in children or sharing imagery. One of the areas I think has been most concerning for us with the declothing and nudifying applications is the people using it are often children themselves. So this would be boys generally creating sexual images of girls in their peers. They are creating child sexual abuse in that process, perhaps not even knowing what they're doing. We've also seen with the AI generated content, not just the type of people using it, but the sort of demands. And the demands seem to be increased for increasingly severe types of content. And with AI, when AI can create whatever you want, the demand seems to be worse. And we're starting to see very concerningly videos as well.
Is what you're saying that it's not the typical person is not like a guy living in his parents' basement? It's a more mainstream person.
I think that is absolutely the concern there. And I think part of that is the availability to find child sexual abuse material now. It's just become so easy. Those barriers have been removed. And the easier it is to do it, the greater chance is that somebody who may never have gone looking, and then there's somebody shared a link or they've seen something. And I don't fully understand that pathway or that journey that people go to from the point where they're on the internet to the point where they see an image and they're searching for images. And then at some point they're in these dark web forums. Research suggests many of those will then go on to seek contact with children themselves. Now, that is a pathway that if we can fully understand that, you can put in interventions and measures to make it harder to intervene before it gets to the very worst stages.
Dan Sexton is Chief Technology Officer at the Internet Watch Foundation, a British charity that's trying to fight against the availability of sexual abuse content online.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
An ad promoting Pakistan International Airways' new flights from Islamabad to Paris has stirred controversy. It depicts a plane flying directly toward the Eiffel Tower. Government officials have said the ad evokes 9/11 imagery, and some have called it a scandal. Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif has ordered a probe into the ad.
In Germany, high-speed train surfing. A passenger missed his train while on a smoke break and, determined not to be left behind, he jumped onto a bracket between two cars as the train sped up to 175 miles an hour. The train stopped after about 19 miles and the man was arrested.
And in Italy, a once-in-a-century discovery, an opulent private bathhouse in the ancient city of Pompeii. It was buried during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius 2,000 years ago, and thanks to the very ash that buried it, frescoes and intricate floor mosaics are strikingly well-preserved.
And those are a few things you might have missed. A bloody, decades-long battle between Turkey and Kurdish separatists in the country could soon come to an end. The Turkish government says it's willing to sit down with the separatists' leader, who's been in jail for 25 years. The outcome of those discussions could also have a profound effect on fighting still going on between Turkish forces and Kurds in northern Syria. The World's Joy Buscarin explains.
Turkish airstrikes on a group of people driving to a protest killed one and injured six in northeastern Syria this week. This video, shared by the Kurdish coalition, shows witnesses carrying injured people away from burned-out cars. They were traveling to a protest against Turkish attacks on the Tishrin Dam, which supplies water and electricity to the Syrian city of Kobani.
YPG'nin de diğer terör örgütlerinin de kafasını
500 miles away in the Turkish capital, parliamentarians applauded as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he would crush the heads of Kurdish militants in Syria.
Suriye'nin doğal kaynaklarını da gasp eden YPG terör örgütü.
If they do not dissolve and lay down their arms, they will not be able to escape their bitter fate, Erdogan said. Turkey considers these Kurdish militias in Syria to be an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. This group has waged an insurgency against the Turkish government for the past 40 years. And so for Turkey, having these militias lead an independent Kurdish region in Syria, right on its border, it's a non-starter. But a surprising group of voices have emerged, suggesting that now may be the time to end the conflict for good. There is one Kurdish political party in Turkey's parliament, the Dem Party. Last month, Dem Party representatives met with the imprisoned leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, for the first time in a decade. This was only possible because in October, an ultranationalist ally of the Turkish president publicly suggested that Öcalan could disband the PKK in exchange for his freedom. Murat Kalmaz is co-chair of the Dem Party's Istanbul branch, speaking through a translator.
Ya bu sorunun başlayan sürecin Kürt tarafından.
Mr. Öcalan is the key person. Is the key person actually for any kind of the talk or for any kind of talks that will happen in this process?
Öcalan, who's now 75 and serving a life sentence on an island prison, said he was open to a deal, but Kalmaz cautions against reading too far into these developments.
Halen devlet tarafında bunu bir hem
because söylende, what is going on between Öcalan and the government is only talks. There is no kind of, you know, granted rights at the moment.
Ceasefire talks between Turkey and the PKK have broken down before, most recently in 2015. But Kamaz and his party are doing their best to make the case to the Turkish government that peace is possible with Kurds in Turkey and northeastern Syria, which Kurdish authorities call Rojava.
Dolayısıyla Rojava'da gerçekleşen devrim Kürtler.
Rojava administration is not a risk or a threat for Turkey or for any country because Rojava administration does not have an agenda or does not have aim to expand their territory. What they are aiming is to basically ensure the protection and safety and security of people that are living in their own territory.
Turkey's 15 million strong Kurdish minority is watching closely. In a part of Istanbul settled by Kurdish families displaced by the PKK insurgency in the 1990s, the entrances to tea houses are hidden behind unmarked doors.
have to make deals with the Kurds. Otherwise, they have to fight with them.
Kurdish journalist Yunus Demir says the election of Donald Trump signaled that the Kurdish militias could quickly lose the backing of the U.S., leaving them vulnerable to a Turkish advance. But it's unlikely that they will give up their territory in Syria easily, after so many battlefield losses in the past decade.
Otherwise, why the Kurds will gonna give 15,000 people for nothing?
Nearby, Kadri Dayar and his wife sell hot plates of chicken and rice. A small dining area is full of posters depicting famous Kurdish landmarks. But just beneath this feeling of stability are Kadri's memories from the 90s. His elderly grandfather, who was beaten by the army for wearing the same brand of shoes preferred by PKK fighters. His village, which the army burned to the ground after accusing them of giving food to militants. The first years in Istanbul, when he could barely make ends meet. We want to live together under one flag, Dyer says. A resolution would be good for everyone in the country. But at the same time, Dyer says, the idea of an independent Kurdish region of Syria excites him, not because he would want to live there, but as a symbol for Kurdish people. I even see it in my dreams, he says. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. It was one of the deadliest battles of World War II. In 1945, the Battle of Okinawa claimed more than 240,000 lives, many of them civilians caught between U.S. forces and the Japanese military. For Okinawans, the scars run deep. As Rebecca Rossman reports from the island, there is still disagreement over what Japanese people are taught about this history.
Surrounded by jagged cliffs overlooking deep blue waters, the Peace Memorial Park, located on the southern tip of Okinawa, easily lives up to its name. But 79 years ago, this scenic spot was the site of the last and most devastating fighting in the Battle of Okinawa. Takahiro Seto is a historian who has been studying this battle for over a decade. In that time, he's collected more than 200 survivor testimonies. He takes me through the memorial. We walk past dozens of marble columns with the names inscribed of soldiers and civilians who died in the three-month campaign. Researchers are still adding names to the marble as they uncover more bone fragments every year. Okinawan civilians suffered more casualties than American and Japanese soldiers combined. By the end of the war, more than a third of the island's population was decimated. Much of this was the result of the fighting, which included heavy American artillery. But Takahiro Seto says there was another contributor to the civilian casualties, one that remains a touchy subject in Japan. Towards the end of the battle, members of the Japanese Imperial Army handed out grenades to groups of Okinawans, encouraging them to kill themselves, warning they risked a far worse fate if captured by American soldiers. While not everyone complied, some did. Despite being well documented, this darker side of Japan's treatment toward its own people continues to face revisionist history. An investigation from a Tokyo-based citizens group found that multiple textbooks had omitted mention about the mass suicides from 2024 editions. To take something that happened and pretend it didn't, especially when it caused so much suffering, is unacceptable, Seto says. The military, which was supposed to protect the people, became their enemy. Erasing this history dishonors those who lived through it. This is also hardly the first attempt at the omission. In 2006, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe introduced the Patriotic Education Act, which aimed to promote national pride by revising historical narratives to be more in line with Japan's post-war self-image. In 2007, mass protests attracted nearly 100,000 people after Japan's education ministry announced high school history textbooks would no longer acknowledge the Imperial Army's responsibility in the mass suicides, citing historical ambiguity. The Japanese government eventually made some concessions after critics pointed out the revision overlooked a number of first-hand testimonies. But the battle over revisionism continues, and it's encouraged more survivors in Okinawa to speak up about what happened to them during the war.
Oh my goodness. That's you as a young boy. How old are you?
Terunobu Yamauchi was only 8 years old at the start of the Battle of Okinawa. He shows me a photo of him taken by an American soldier at the end of the battle. Yamauchi is standing with his family and dozens of other Okinawans in front of a cave where they hid on and off for months as the fighting rampaged. Now 89, Yamauchi only started speaking about his experience during the war several years ago. He says he was encouraged after realizing he was one of only a handful of survivors still alive. I realized people like me had a responsibility to tell the truth about what really happened, he says. If we rewrite history, we hand future generations fiction instead of truth. For Okinawans, who in large part have always felt like second-class citizens compared to the Japanese mainland, it's also about something bigger, acknowledgement.
Acknowledgement is essential to transitional justice.
Jeffrey Kingston teaches Japanese history at Temple University's Tokyo campus.
I think many Okinawans remain unreconciled with the wartime past precisely because the government has tried to suppress these memories and try to burnish this history in ways that overlook what the Japanese military inflicted on the Okinawan people.
Without that proper acknowledgement, Kingston says, there can be no reconciliation between Okinawans and the Japanese mainland. Back at the Peace Memorial, historian Takehiro Seto says pride shouldn't trump facts. Learning from the past is essential, he says. If we don't, we risk repeating the same mistakes. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Okinawa.
The band Osibisa was one of the first Afro-rock bands to gain international fame back in the 1970s. It was funky, it was psychedelic, and it was led by Ghanaian multi-instrumentalist Teddy Osei, who passed away in London this week. He told Afro TV Ghana in 2019 about being a teenager in Kumasi, Ghana, and about a neighbor who got him interested in music.
Every evening when I finish work, I go to their house where the instruments are. I picked up the tenor saxophone and start messing it up.
In the mid-1960s, Osei followed other Ghanaians to London and formed a band with several of his countrymen, plus musicians from the Caribbean. No one sounded like Osibisa. An American record company took a gamble and sent the band to a recording studio.
Everybody, do what you do.
Their first album hit the top 10 in the UK and in the US.
We played it almost everywhere, from America to Japan to India to everywhere.
Touring the world, huge concert venues, Osibisa paved the way for other African musicians to make it in the West, such as Fela Kuti and Angelique Kidjo. When he was much older, Osei said that the band's whirlwind success was hard to remember. But one stop stood out.
I mean, for me, coming back to Ghana and going to Kumasi, or my parents to be there to see me, was a mind blower. My mind blower.
Teddy Osei passed away in London this past Tuesday. He was 88. One song by Osibisa has particular resonance this week. It's about going home again.
We are going.
Yaya by Teddy Osei's band Osibisa brings our show to a close.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.